and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at.
So we do have to have substantive conversations around revenue streams that challenges.
Mayor Johnson reacts as legislation to fund public transit stalls in Springfield. Our Spotlight Politics team unpacks that and more.
We're now one step closer to realizing President Trump's promise to make America healthy again.
What you should know about the Trump administration's new COVID vaccine recommendations.
It's very, very, very important for museums to step into that space and step up and represent everyone.
And inside the Chicago History Museum for a sneak peek at an upcoming exhibit exploring the city's Latino history. And now to some of today's top stories. Chicago's gun offender registry is incomplete and unreliable. That's a quote from the Chicago Inspector General's office. The IG's new report cites numerous issues with the city's gun offender registry ordinance, like lack of enforcement, procedural controls, and inconsistent guidance. The ordinance requires anyone convicted of certain firearm-related charges to register during their release from custody or sentencing. But the IG report found that some offenders who are supposed to register are not informed that they need to do so due to coordination issues between the Chicago Police Department and jails and prisons. A CPD official says the department is willing to coordinate with the city to review the registry and evaluate ways in which it can be strengthened to work better. For more on this story, please check out our website. Soccer fans will have a new place to catch the home team play. The Chicago Fire Football Club today announced plans for a brand new 22,000-seat open-air soccer stadium in the 78. The proposed arena would provide a much-needed anchor for other residential and commercial developments at that 62-acre site in the South Loop. And team owner Joe Mansueto says he will personally finance the $650 million cost. The project could break ground this fall or early next year, with hopes to open in time for the 2028 season. Later in the program, a sneak preview of an upcoming exhibit at the Chicago History Museum showcasing the city's Latino history, and they want your photos. But up next, some confusion and concerns over the Trump administration's changes to COVID vaccine guidelines.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
The Trump administration is releasing new COVID vaccine guidelines for millions of Americans.
The COVID vaccine for healthy children and healthy pregnant women has been removed from the CDC recommended immunization schedule. Last year, the Biden administration urged healthy children to get yet another COVID shot despite the lack of any clinical data to support the repeat booster strategy in children.
That ends today. It's common sense and it's good science.
But the CDC seemingly contradicted Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. by issuing updated guidance saying healthy kids may get the vaccine in consultation with a doctor or healthcare provider. And the agency's stance for pregnant people now is no guidance. So joining us to discuss this some more is Dr. Katrine Wallace, a professor of epidemiology at the University of Illinois Chicago. Katrine, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this recommendation coming from the federal government, it's a bit unclear because, especially for pregnant people, because even then the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, they are still recommending the shot for pregnant people, saying, quote, vaccines are recommended during pregnancy to protect against serious illnesses. The most common vaccines given in pregnancy include the flu, Tdap, COVID-19, and RSV. These vaccines can keep you healthy and help protect your baby after birth. Katrine, what's your reaction to this move by the federal government, you know, removing this recommendation for children and healthy people?
Yes, healthcare providers and experts have been perplexed by this sudden change because, as you probably know, because you report on these things, is that every time a new vaccine is available, there is a open forum where the advisors to the CDC go through the data in a very transparent way. Any new data that could kind of update the risk-benefit calculus for a vaccine in a certain group is discussed. And we aren't really aware of any new data that should change that risk-benefit calculus, and any data that might have been used to make these decisions really wasn't communicated. So it has been a little bit confusing to healthcare providers and people that, you know, need to recommend this to their patients. But it does seem like they have moved to, like you were saying, the CDC has moved to a sort of a risk-sharing kind of talk to your provider, which may have positive implications for insurance coverage, aside from just saying not to get it.
So then what do parents and pregnant people need to know?
Right. So especially in pregnancy, this was a surprising about face, because in pregnancy, actually, as the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology correctly point out, is that pregnancy can be very dangerous, or COVID can be very dangerous in pregnancy. It increases the risk of severe disease, hospitalization, ICU visits, and death. The rates of all those things are higher in pregnant people with COVID-19 as opposed to non-pregnant individuals. And also, it can infect and damage the placenta during pregnancy. So it leads to adverse pregnancy outcomes like miscarriage, stillbirth, preeclampsia, and preterm labor, which are all bad. And the vaccine also prevents the newborn from hospitalization after birth, because antibodies from the vaccine gets passed from the parent to the newborn and protects them after birth. And something like 80% of infant hospitalizations for COVID were from unvaccinated mothers.
Okay, so to that point, the most recent data from the CDC shows that the latest COVID booster uptake rate is low. It is only 23% for adults and 13% for children. Should that be higher?
I believe it should be higher. As we were talking about before, every year there's, when the new vaccine comes out, we go through the risks and the benefits of the vaccine in each age group. And every year in all the age groups, it has been found that the risks, the benefits rather, outweigh the risks in every age group. The benefits of preventing these severe outcomes outweigh the risks of the vaccine. So I do believe those should be higher.
So is there worry then that with the change in federal recommendations or lack thereof, might that affect accessibility to the vaccine? Can we still get it? Will my insurance still cover it?
Yeah, so I think especially for young children, I'm worried, because every year I get a lot of questions about where to get the pediatric doses already. So anything that could affect that being available is problematic for people that still want to get it. And then your question about insurance is a good one. Hopefully, because we're going to like a risk sharing sort of talk to your provider instead of like it's just not available, perhaps that's a better scenario for insurance, but it kind of remains to be seen.
This news, of course, it comes as this new COVID subvariant has emerged, NB181. It's been detected in a few states already, not Illinois. Will the latest booster protect us against that variant?
So luckily, this new variant that you're talking about that has now made landfall in the United States is kind of on the same branch of the viral family tree as the vaccine that we got in the fall. So it should offer some protection. We have heard that it is not more severe, this variant, and the symptoms are similar, but that it is more transmissible and perhaps a little bit better at evading our immune defenses.
There seems to be a pattern of new infections or new variants sort of emerging in the summer months. Are higher rates of infection common in the summer? Because we tend to think of like the flu, that's in the colder months usually.
Yeah, that's a great question, because as much as we want to categorize this as a seasonal virus, it really has not lived up to that as much as we want to will that into being. So we have seen a summer surge the last 4 years. And so that's why we're a little concerned about low vaccination rates. So if people have not gotten the most recent COVID vaccine, it really is not too late at this point to get it, because we are seeing these new, more transmissible variants kind of hitting our radar.
An increase in vaccine hesitancy is also happening at the same time when we're seeing a national measles outbreak, concerns about bird flu, E. coli. What are your concerns with some of these?
So it's extremely concerning. We had a lot of misinformation swirling about vaccines during COVID-19 on social media and such. And these have unfortunately spilled over into other vaccines. And it's very concerning, especially for the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. Especially the measles part of that vaccine is one of the best vaccines we have. It's so safe. It is so effective. But we need 95% of a community to be protected in order to not have outbreaks. And so we're seeing communities where that herd immunity level is eroding. And we actually have 10% of schools in Illinois have less than 91%, which is kind of problematic, you know, for potential outbreaks. So, yes, I think a lot of misinformation that kind of started during the pandemic has spilled over into other things, and now we're seeing it manifest itself with other outbreaks.
Okay. Well, we'll see how it goes. Yeah. Katrine Wallace, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Up next, state funding for transit at a crossroads. Our Spotlight Politics team breaks down the latest right after this. With potential cuts looming, lawmakers in Springfield fail to pass a regional transit funding bill. Meanwhile, Mayor Brandon Johnson's hiring practices come under scrutiny from the Justice Department, and the U.S. Supreme Court agrees to hear a challenge from Illinois Congressman Mike Bost. Here with all that and more is our Spotlight Politics team, Heather Sharone and Nick Blumberg. Nick, let's start with this transit bill and the alleged failure of it. You were in Springfield last week. A version of the bill did pass the Senate. House did not take any action. Do we know why this stalled out?
That's right. Well, you know, the House Speaker did not call the bill for a vote, and there weren't really members publicly calling for one. It's worth pointing out that there was a Senate version of the bill that passed. There was also a version of this reform measure in the House backed by State Rep. Evadina Delgado. That was a pretty similar governance reform plan, but there weren't revenue measures in there. You know, the timeline was really tight. Both the Senate and House bills were filed on Wednesday. Lawmakers, of course, were supposed to adjourn on Saturday. You know, revenue measures, especially in a difficult budget year, are tough for lawmakers. And the Senate version did get some pushback. You know, some unions were concerned over things like a toll surcharge that was ultimately altered. Also, the idea of using some of the interest from the state's road fund, which did stay in. But, you know, there was also some pushback over the potential to expand rideshare fees beyond Chicago to the Cook County suburb, or to the, you know, Chicago suburbs in Cook County, as well as to the collar counties. And it's worth noting that, you know, Uber, the rideshare companies, have a heavy lobbying presence and a lot of influence in Springfield.
So the RTA, they're projecting a $771 million shortfall in the operating budget for Chicagoland Transit. What happens if more support from Springfield does not manifest?
Well, agencies have been very clear. You know, they're going to have to immediately start planning for cuts. This is 20% of the budget, could be a 40% reduction in service. Worth noting, these are plans. These are not necessarily going to go into effect tomorrow. They expect to have enough money to get through the end of the year. But depending on the timeline, they're going to have to hold some hearings to discuss the impacts of those cuts, make sure folks are aware of it. You know, transit advocates and agencies really want to see lawmakers go back over the summer to potentially deal with this in a special session. Governor hasn't said one way or another whether he intends to call one. It's also worth noting, though, that if they go back over the summer and they pass a bill and they want it to take immediate effect, it's not a simple majority that'll do it. It needs a 60% vote. Now, assuming they don't pick up a significant Republican support, Democrats control about 67% of the General Assembly, so they could do it, but not a lot of margin for error there.
And there's a reason why people are calling this the doomsday scenario. So those 40% of cuts could mean 75 bus lines closed. There are only 127 bus lines in Chicago, and it could cause four of the CTA's seven train lines to shut down, which would have massive impacts on the way people get to work and to school, and it would be massively disruptive for the city's economy. I asked Mayor Brandon Johnson about that a little bit today, and I think we can listen to what he's going to say.
We can.
I'm encouraged by some of the work that has gone forward, but what happens in this next phase, we have to ensure that the resources are there to give more confidence that as we continue to build a safe, affordable city, that the public way can be moved with expediency with a properly funded transportation system. So I'm going to always remain hopeful and confident that we can get a deal done that works for the people of Chicago.
Heather, did the mayor offer any more specifics?
He didn't. He didn't seem particularly alarmed by it, but he also didn't say, yes, I'm really in favor of that delivery surcharge, or I'm in favor of this specific governance change, because that's a part of this too, and it could severely change sort of the city's ability to control what happens at the RTA. It would probably give more, or at least the current proposal would give more power to the collar counties and suburban mayors. What that means for sort of Chicago's ability to control its own transit system is very much part of the equation here.
Although it's been really interesting, too, to hear from some of those suburban lawmakers and county executives, they're concerned about this being a Chicago takeover. So, you know, maybe that's a good sign that it is a compromise deal, because nobody's 100% happy.
Nick, any other notable bills that failed to progress?
Yeah, I mean, I'll flag a few of the things that we've been covering for folks in recent months. There was the idea of some new registration requirements for parents who homeschool their children. Supporters say these were, pretty modest efforts just to make sure kids are getting an adequate education. But there was a lot of concern from parents groups about, having their rights infringed upon. There was also the notion to allow community colleges to offer certain high demand four-year degrees. That did move ahead, but it got some pushback from lawmakers, including members of the Black Caucus. When we heard from the governor last week, he said he was, still hopeful that it would get called. Ultimately, no movement. Another effort that Pritzker backed to ban cell phones in classrooms, that also did not move forward. There were concerns about parents reaching their kids, especially, God forbid, in some sort of an emergency, as well as it being a potentially, a punitive measure to use against students.
Yeah, a lot of talk, about concerns of kids having cell phones in schools, something Heather and I know a little bit about.
We do.
So, Heather, Mayor Brandon Johnson's hiring practices are under scrutiny, as we know, by the Justice Department. You've been taking a closer look at his senior staff and other key hires. What did you find?
Well, as opposed to Mayor Lori Lightfoot and Mayor Rahm Emanuel, his appointments in senior staff are more reflective to sort of the racial breakdown of Chicago, which is one-third white, one-third black, and one-third Latino. But most of his appointments are women. Most of his appointments, nearly half, are black. And that is sort of the center of the Department of Justice's probe into sort of his hiring practice. The mayor is very proud that he has appointed mostly black people to help lead the city. He says that's appropriate because of Chicago's history, but it has drawn the ire of the White House. Interestingly, the Chicago Tribune had a nice analysis today showing that nearly 85% of the president's cabinet is white.
Alder people, electeds, what of other Chicagoans? What's their reaction to this analysis and to the mayor's hiring practices?
Well, Chicago, I guess there's, the old saw that the only issue in Chicago politics is race. And it is sort of seen as a zero-sum game. If somebody is black is leading this agency, that means somebody who's white is not. And for many decades, that is how Chicago sort of ran City Hall. It was essentially a local version of the spoil system. Now, that has changed, and it's supposed to be based on merit. and it's supposed to be based on sort of who can do the best job. But that is not always the case, because it is, you know, not for any reason that Chicago's, you know, unofficial motto is ubi es mia, where is mine? And that is sort of what this all breaks down to.
Okay. Nick, U.S. Supreme Court said yesterday that it will hear an appeal from Illinois Republican Congressman Mike Bost about the state's decision to count absentee ballots after Election Day. What is the substance of his challenge?
That's right. Bost says, you know, right now, Illinois State Board of Elections, as long as it's postmarked by Election Day, they will continue counting ballots for 14 additional days. Bost says that violates federal law because federal law sets when Election Day is. The conservative activist group Judicial Watch is also backing him on this effort. They've been involved in, you know, sort of measures like these elsewhere, too, pushing back against mail-in ballots. Now, so far, lower courts in the Bost case, they basically said he doesn't have standing because he hasn't been able to demonstrate that there is some potential harm for candidates for public office. But the Supreme Court did agree to take up this appeal. They are expected to hear it sometime in the fall, which means we will have a decision sometime in the first half of next year, probably.
Okay. An interesting one to see, as we know. But mail-in balloting has been a really, it's grown, certainly, in the last few elections. Okay, Spotlight, that's it. I'll see you both next week. Nick Blumberg, Heather Schroem, thank you. Up next, exploring Chicago's Latino roots in an upcoming exhibit. An upcoming exhibit at the Chicago History Museum is celebrating the long and vibrant history of Latinos in the city. The exhibit, aptly called Aquí in Chicago, is still in development, but our Joanna Hernandez recently got an exclusive preview. Here's another look.
From glamorous quinceañera dresses to a ceremonial mass from an indigenous community, these items will be displayed in an exhibit celebrating the long history of Latinos in Chicago.
We have a lot of interesting material in the exhibition, from photos, oral histories, cultural treasures, garments, textiles, artwork. There's a lot of representation of local artists.
The project has taken years to develop. The idea came from a group of high school students at the Instituto Justice and Leadership Academy in Pilsen, who visited the museum in 2019 and noticed a lack of representation for Latinos.
The students are in my vest pocket every step of the way throughout this project. They each wrote letters to the History Museum describing the harm that it perpetrated on their communities to find nothing about their histories here.
Elena Gonzalez has been working on the upcoming exhibition for the last 4 years.
Latine communities are all over the city, not only in Pilsen or Humble Park or Little Village, but in every single community in Chicago.
Latinos are the second largest racial group in Chicago, representing nearly 30% of the city's population, according to the 2020 census. Part of the exhibition will feature a digital scrapbook where Chicagoans can share their photos.
You'll be able to browse and view in the gallery, and everyone can submit their photos of events, people, places that they feel are important to the Latine stories of Chicago.
This collection features images from a popular candy store that opened in Little Village in the 1990s, along with snapshots of a local artist painting a mural in the 1980s.
In the time that we're living through right now, that everyone understand their heritage as, you know, how they came here. Unless you're Native American, you came here in one way or another, and those stories all shape the Chicago we know.
Gonzalez says the exhibition also explores the large indigenous population from Latin American heritage, including the Quechua community.
An indigenous community in Ecuador. There's a local community of about 30 to 40 Quechua Otavalo families here in Chicago, and this ensemble was a recent gift.
Other pieces will dive into the history of a quinceañera, the coming-of-age celebration for a young woman turning 15 years old.
We were very fortunate to work with Mi Quince World, which is a shop on 26th Street here in Chicago, to create these beautiful gowns that are now part of the
permanent collection of the Chicago History Museum. So the one behind me is the charro style gown, which speaks to a very Mexican heritage.
Collections and pieces are currently being worked on. In the meantime, if you visit the museum, you'll likely see an artist painting a mural at the entrance of the exhibit.
I want people to feel included. I want people to feel visible. I want people to, people who are allies and maybe not necessarily Latine themselves, I want them to feel that they are also part of this Chicago.
For Chicago Tonight, I'm Joanna Hernandez.
The exhibit is set to officially open October 25th at the Chicago History Museum. To learn more about submitting your photos and the project, check out our website, wttw.com/news. And that's our show for this Tuesday night. Stay connected with our reporters and what they're working on by following us on Instagram at WTTW Chicago. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Chicago State University has its first ever head football coach, a preview of what's to come for the team. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that supports educational initiatives in the legal profession.